You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. The officers of the Charlottesville Area League of Women Voters, Karen Yates, Jerry Yemen, and Patricia Hurst, discuss the mission of the League of Women Voters, its history, and the positions adopted by the organization. The officers spoke at the Wednesday, June 10, 2015 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Jeff Gould. Our podcast is entitled The League of Women Voters. Here's Jeff Gould.
Thank you, and once again, thank the Senior Center for allowing us to be partnering with them for, I guess, many years now. It's a wonderful opportunity for us to be here and to be open to the public. And I wanted to just take a moment while you know that it is free and open to the public, but we would be very, very happy if all of you in this room and your friends and neighbors became members of the Senior Statesmen. And that's very easy to do. There's a very short form back there you can fill out. We'd be happy to have your support. Financial part of the support is only $15, and that just allows us to continue the work that we do here. What? Stop the 20? Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, what can I say? It's still a bargain, folks. And I wanted to introduce our program here today. You know, for many years, Senior Statesmen and the League of Women Voters have been complementary in many of the projects and efforts they do. We both have, from time to time, generally almost every year, a political forum of some type. And they've been both popular and, I think, helpful to inform our citizenry. So we thought, let's have this, the League here to tell us a little bit about what they do and their history here in the community. And I'd like to introduce you to Karen Yates, who has been president of the League of Women Voters of the Charlottesville area since 2012. She's a graduate of
Juniata.
Thank you, in Pennsylvania. She was a research chemist at NIH for 17 years, and she worked in a medical company in Pittsburgh for 15 years as a manager. And she's been here in the community for some time. She does volunteer work with the Meals on Wheels. She and her husband, Professor John Yates Jr., have two sons and six grandchildren. So I welcome, let's give her a warm Senior Statesman welcome.
Almost walked off of that.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much for inviting us here today. I was musing about what was bringing me here today, how I got here, and I think it was through maybe the Daily Progress, an ad that you were having a meeting and Dahlia Lithwick was going to speak on the Supreme Court. That was about a year ago, and I came and joined you, and it was such an exciting meeting. After that, I looked up your website, which is absolutely great, and saw that we had a lot of similarities. You were a nonpartisan organization who wanted to educate the citizenry so that they were more informed to participate in their community. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan organization who strives to educate citizenry so that they can be more informed voters. So I emailed your board, had coffee at Seaville Coffee with some of them to see if perhaps we could do something together, to see if we could complement, you know, we weren't doing the same thing, using up the same energy, whether we could coordinate our work. And through that conversation, we are here today because during coffee, the people there said, well, gee, I didn't know that. I didn't know that about the League. So I am here today with Pat Hurst, who is our treasurer. and has been a member of the League of Women Voters of the Charlottesville area for 6 years, and has served as president, treasurer, and secretary for that organization, and has just been elected to the state League of Women Voters board. And I'm also here with Jerry Yemen, our secretary. Jerry's been a member for 17 years in the Charlottesville area and is a senior researcher with the Darden Graduate School of Business. I have been, maybe not consistently, but I have been a member of the League of Women Voters since 1961. I've learned that Ms. Lieberman has beat me by 2 years. She joined in 1959. A friend invited me in Yellow Springs, Ohio, to come to a League meeting, and I went. And they were having a study on the court system in the state of Ohio. It was interesting. I continued with the League ever since then. In Montgomery County, Maryland, in Allegheny County, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and now here for the last 6 years. It's a group in which you meet very interesting, engaged people, and I'm very proud to be a member of the League. The next thing I want to actually read to you, because I don't want to ad lib it, and that is the mission of the League. The League of Women Voters, a nonpartisan political organization, encourages informed and active participation in government, works to increase understanding of major public policy issues, and influences public policy through education and advocacy. You heard that we are the same in nonpartisanship. Where we differ is we are nonpartisan political. We, as a League and as members, vote on issues at the local level, at the state level, at the national level, the issues that we wish to study. These studies can take anywhere from 2 to 4 years. After we study an issue, one of them we studied was the issue of prisons, their place in our country today. If after we study, we see that what we call a we find we have a consensus of the group about this particular issue, then we as a League will lobby. We will, as a group, contact our congressional representatives or our local representatives, depending at what level we're studying. So we are formed both as a taxable, or it's 501(c) and a 501(c)(4) organizations. Some of our dues are not tax deductible, and our dues are $55 because it costs money to support a national organization. What the League has and continues to have is a very, very good reputation for intellectual integrity. We are asked on the national level by congressmen to please come to different committee meetings if they know we have studied a particular item, to please come and let them know where the League stands on this particular issue. We go in Charlottesville to city council. We go in for Albemarle County to the Board of Supervisors, and we speak on issues for which a lot of work has gone into. So that makes the difference in the organizations. We not only study and educate, but we actually act and lobby. I'm sure your education doesn't really stop just because you came to a meeting. I'm sure you as citizens go out and use that information. So I don't want to interfere or interfere that you do that. So our greatest assets is today, the League of Women Voters, is our reputation on our intellectual rigor. This allows the League to open doors, to be invited into the table, and be taken very seriously. This is very important because we are in an age where absolutely anything goes in public debate. Allegiance to the truth doesn't exist very much anymore because the first consideration is often getting your way or getting elected. Let's see. I think at this point, I will turn the podium over to Pat Hurst for some history. And should you have any questions at the end of our presentation, we'd be happy to answer those for you. Pat?
Okay, thank you, Karen. Jim, am I on? Yes, thank you. He tells me this works in the parking lot, so I'm impressed. So it's very nice to be here with you today. I know we have a lot of overlap in our organizations, like Karen said, because when I was here a few minutes ago, I saw two people in the back. One was a League member and one wasn't. So I went back there to say hello, and I went walked in on a conversation they were having about League business. And it's like, oh, I'm like being in a League meeting. So we do have some overlap here. I want to tell you about the history of the League and some interesting things about us, where we came from, how we got started. Our early roots and founding really color our organization today, and we refer back to our roots, a lot of the quotes, the people that were there quite frequently in the League. So we were founded in 1920. By a strong woman named Carrie Chapman Catt. And she was a leader nationally and internationally in the women's suffrage movement that lasted for 71 years, and I'll talk more about that. But she was leader in the largest suffrage organization, NAWSA, and she founded the International Suffrage Alliance. Now, we're very much intertwined with this suffrage movement. The 19th Amendment passed in 1920, and that's the year that we were founded. So you know there's a very close connection. And the League of Women Voters is a natural next step to that women's movement. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that movement. It started in Seneca Falls, New York. You probably have heard of the Seneca Falls Women Convention. It was 2 days in 1948. Now, this meeting, it does have some women associated with it, such as Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but it was really put together, I discovered, by the Quakers in that area who joined up with these women that were starting to be leaders and formed this conference. There were 300 people that came to the conference, and after 2 days it ended in a vote for what is called the Declaration of Sentiments. And the Declaration of Sentiments is formed after our Declaration of Independence. And it starts out and it talks about the great precept of nature dictated by God himself, superior in obligation to any other, and then therefore. And there are 11 resolutions. And the third one says that woman is man's equal, was intended to be so by the Creator, and the highest good of the race demands that should be recognized as such. And then you go on down to the 9th resolution, and it says, that is the duty of the women of this country to secure to themselves their sacred right to the elective franchise. And then 71 years later, in 1920, the 19th Amendment was passed. The right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any states on account of sex. Now, 100 people signed that resolution. Here's a little sketch of the gathering. There were 300 in attendance, like I believe I said, 100 signed, and 38 of those were men. So it was not just women. Frederick Douglass was there. If you remember, he published the North Star, and he was a very visible and vocal and active anti-slavery person. So he signed that, and other men's as well. Now, over the next 71 years, I call it fighting for the vote, because the women really got out. They grew in numbers. Their support grew. Eventually, people came to support them throughout the United States. There were many women involved. I've listed a few names. Susan B. Anthony is one that comes to people's mind. Carrie Chapman, Cat, our founder. Sojourner Truth, Lucy Stone. Quite a few men, as I've mentioned, various organizations, and this is some of them. The largest was the National American Woman Suffrage Association, and Carrie Chapman Catt was the leader of that group. There were small steps that were taken, quite a number of small steps toward the march to women's suffrage, and I've listed three as examples. In 1896 in Utah, Utah joined the Union and granted full women's suffrage in that state. In 1996, you had Idaho adopting a state constitution amendment enfranchising women to vote. In 1917, we had the first woman U.S. House of Representatives, who was Jeanette Rankin of Montana. So there were a lot of small steps leading up to 1920. There were publications, there were parades, there were demonstrations, there were conventions held, and the momentum built. I want to mention a couple of these as representative of things that occurred. In 2013, when Woodrow Wilson, the day before he was inaugurated as the president, there was a demonstration. There was a march from the Capitol. Is this too loud? No, not, thank you. I've got 2013 in my notes. I'll have to change that before I pass it on. There was a march of 8,000 suffragettes from the U.S. Capitol past the White House in support. There were 500,000 spectators, you know, in that area from parades and so forth. And many opponents were against the women's fight for suffrage. And they were also upset that they would march on the day before the inauguration. But these are some of the things they did. They hurled insults. They hurled lighted cigar butts. They spit on women marchers. They slapped them. They mobbed them. They beat them. And the marchers had a permit, but the police did not come to their aid. The army troops were called to come to the aid of the marchers, and the police chief was later fired. There were 200 marchers injured in that situation too. But that really gained the sympathy of a lot of people. And then the next parade that the marchers for such a reject had, it like doubled the previous one. There were more people coming out. In 1917. Yes, that's the right year. At Occoquan workhouse, which is in a security facility in the D.C. area. There was an incident that was portrayed in the 2004 film Iron-Jawed Angels. You may have seen it. It talked about women of the movement. And it talked about a six-month period when some of the marchers were imprisoned in this facility and were treated very badly and abused. There was one, November the 14th, 1917. It was even called the Night of Terror by the media at the time because the prisoners were beaten and abused. And there was force feeding of the women that were in prison. And we talk about force feeding today, and it was really an eye-opener to learn that these women had undergone the same thing that Guantanamo, our prisoners, undergo today. So a lot of activity back then. And this is a famous saying by Susan B. Anthony. No self-respecting woman would wish or work for the success of a party that ignores her sex. And there they are in front of the National Women's Party building. You know, I went on Google. I wanted to look up the exact wording. I had this picture. And I put in, no self-respecting woman would. And Google came up with some options. This was the first one, but the second one was, no self-respecting woman dresses like a man. No self-respecting woman would go without makeup. So I thought that was pretty cute. So 1920, we come to the founding of the League of Women Voters. Carrie Chapman Catt, she was a high school teacher from Wisconsin. And she eventually, after her husband died, she was in the newspaper business, and then she got involved in the suffragette movement. It's interesting that she later, in 1941, received a national award called the Chi Omega for National Achievement. And it was awarded at the White House by Eleanor Roosevelt. And Eleanor Roosevelt was a founding member of the League, which is an interesting tidbit. And she was later inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. But it's a natural first step to suffrage, and you can see here the dates. March of 1919, she proposed a League of Women Voters. It was not named yet, so it was a League. In June, the 19th Amendment passes Congress. Then in February of the next year, the League was formed. And then in August, the 19th Amendment was ratified. So it's just very much intertwined. She talked about finishing the fight by forming the League. And she meant finishing the fight by, now that we are securing the right to vote, we need to get out and educate the public so that we will have the informed citizenry. And we owe it to our children and our grandchildren. And for almost 100 years, the League has sought to fulfill her goal. This is a picture of the first board. You see in the lower right, Mrs. Catt, the president, honorary president. The first president was a Mrs. Maud Park. You can see their clothes at that time. Very interesting. Now, the structure of the First League, not surprisingly, it inherited its structure from the suffragette association that Catt was the leader of. And that was really a top-down. It was a federation of state leagues that soon expanded to local leagues. The state of Virginia had our league was formed in November of 1920. Our local league didn't come along until around 1946, but Virginia was there very early. And there was a dual advantage of having the grassroots in this early structure, the people in the local leagues that would actually do the work, and the decisions were made at the top central level, which was the board of the League of Women Voters. Now, that provided training ground for future political candidates. And Eleanor Roosevelt made a statement, "I've always found that the best workers in a political party frequently are graduates of the League of Women Voters." And that was because of the structure, because it was so similar to our federal government and being, you know, top down with things being implemented at the state level. In 1944, we changed our names to the League of Women Voters of the United States, and at the same time, the autonomy shifted to local leagues and the power became invested there. And so no longer did the board at the national level set the agenda and make the positions and so forth and decide what legislative would be, what legislatures, legislation would be on our agenda. But that was down at the local level, and it still is. So we have local positions, like Karen said. We have state conventions where we vote on state positions and things we're going to pursue politically. And then we have national conventions where our members gather and vote on positions there. So it's a very grassroots in that respect today, where the decisions come from below as well. Today, there are about 800 local leagues in the United States. So one of the things we do is we set goals for public policy programs. These are the political issues that we will take positions on, we will advocate for, we will lobby for, we will visit our legislators, we will write articles, we would all those things to try to get a particular piece of legislation through the system. Our model, as Karen mentioned, we study an issue, members agree on an issue, and then we take action, and that remains in place, has been throughout our history. We lobby at the national level and at the state level and at the local level. It's interesting that in 1920, the League was very involved with the political parties. They were nonpartisan, but to the extent that they worked for issues to be included on the platforms of both parties. And I found that interesting. It didn't go beyond the 20s, but it was in the early years. And I would like to read a quote by Kat about the being political but nonpartisan again. She noted that is in answer to the question, is the League political? Certainly, but not partisan. Its members are as free as other women to join and vote for the party of their choice. They make no pledge otherwise in joining the League. So we have Democrats, we have Republicans, we have Independents, we have Green Party throughout the League, and all the others too, if they exist. Now, the next few slides, I don't want to really go through them, but I included activities that we've been involved in, political issues of the day, of that decade, to let you know in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, all the way up to the present, the League has been involved in the major issues of our day, in the political issues of our day. So in the 1920s, I'll just point out, now the 20s were an interesting time. There was a lot of organization and getting out the vote and getting people involved in politics. And you see it in 1928, the League sponsored Meet the Candidates, which was the first national radio broadcast of a candidate forum. We had candidate questionnaires and meetings of the candidates and the townspeople, get out the vote campaigns, know your town surveys. So a lot of activity at the grassroots level. 30s, 40s, and 50s, some of the things we were involved in, we supported and worked for the Social Security, Food and Drug Acts, Tennessee Valley Authority that brought electricity to the Tennessee Valley. It's interesting, the second bullet. We're the only organization working for merit hiring of government personnel, which up until this time had been according to the crony system and the spoils system and so forth. And legislation did pass in the 30s that created the civil service so that you had certain criteria that you had to meet in order to be hired for certain government positions. And then we supported the National United Nations and International Monetary Fund. 60s and 70s, we supported presidential suffrage for Washington, D.C. residents. So even today, the residents can't vote in the presidential elections. They're sort of left out. So the League was an early supporter of that. We were one of the first organizations to call for normalization with China. You remember Richard Nixon going to China in that era. The Equal Rights Amendment started in that time. In 1976, I'll point out that the League sponsored the first televised presidential debate since 1960, and we continued through 1984. This shows two of the debates, the 1976 presidential forum that was Carter Mondale. Now, this is the panel that was questioning them at that forum or debate. The other one is Ronald Reagan debate. And then over to the right is just an example of a League member going out in their own car, you know, trying to get out the vote during those many, many years. In the 80s and 90s, there are several things. Number 1993 is National Voter Registration Act. That's commonly called the Motor Voter Act, so that we can register to vote when we go get our driver's license, and the League supported that. We came out in support of gun control, Clean Air Act reauthorization, health care for all. And in the 21st century, we have supported, continue to support. We filed amicus briefs at the Supreme Court. We adopted a democracy agenda to focus on things that are currently being discussed, redistricting, civil liberties, campaign finance, and so forth. Now, I went online a couple of days ago just to see what Leaguers throughout the United States were talking about. And so if you go to our national website, the members can go into an area of blogging. And so this is four of the key areas that people were talking about. So it was the Voting Rights Act, it was the Keystone Pipeline, the Ferguson situation, and voter ID bills. And so I just thought that was interesting of what we're doing today. I included a couple of pictures, but I had so many of the historical ones, I thought you might want to see some modern ones. And these were taken within the last year. On the left is our legislators luncheon that we hold every year. And there we have five of our legislators in Virginia that joined us for lunch. And on the right is a community dialogue. We have those monthly in the winter. And they deal with issues much like your speakers that you have here. This one was on trash management, and it was really a success. A lot of people joined that. So I just close with the mission statement and the goal that that has been read to you by Karen, and thank you very much. I hope you enjoy that. And I will pass it now.
Thanks, Pat.
Yes.
Thank you. If you are the president the League of Women Voters of Charlottesville, as I am not allowed to participate in any political party, event, anything that Tea Party, Democrats, Republicans have, wiener roasts, barbecues, information. I cannot be there. absolutely have to remove myself for that. And Dina Imlay, who is our voter service representative, is under the same set of rules. Those two positions
of president and voter service removes us completely from doing anything with a political party. That is, so we try really, really hard to separate ourselves from any particular group. We never support or negate a candidate or a party. And this is not always easy. The other members of the board are under rules that when they act on behalf of the league, they need to also separate themselves from parties. Or if they're going to run for office, they have to remove themselves from the board. Our membership, when they're running forums, registering people to vote, are asked, please remove your support so-and-so buttons. You're there for the league. Don't advertise anything else. So I wanted to insert those before, that information before I call on Jerry, and then we're happy, all of us, to answer any questions you may have at the end. Jerry Yemen.
Okay, thank you for having us today, and I'm going to talk to you about how I got to the League of Women Voters. It's a different path than perhaps others have had, and I'm going to talk to you through anecdotes of some of the influence that the League of Women Voters has. And I will end this with the organization of persuasion that the League of Women Voters really is. So unlike many of you who probably grew up with parents or were members of the League of Women Voters, your mother, I had never heard of them. I didn't know who they were. I was in graduate school, and I was studying voting behavior. I didn't understand why Americans didn't turn out to vote. I was curious about it, and so I was working on some empirical studies. And at that time, there's a school of thought that, well, Americans don't vote because it's just too hard. You have to register to vote. At that time, it was hard because the registrars were only open certain hours. And, I sort of subscribed to that school of thought, which was, oh, yeah, that's a lot of work. Now, I will confess, I'm Canadian. So it just, what happens was that when you wanted to vote, they would come around to the houses and you get on the voter list. They'd just knock on the door and ask if you were 18, you're allowed to vote, and the list would be put in the end of your street. If your name wasn't on it, you called the government and they put your name on it. That was the end. So perhaps it's changed since then, but that was the way that it used to be. So I was convinced of this. Well, one of the things I needed to find for my empirical methods was the hours that your registrar offices were open. Now, this is before the time that I could just go online and look that up. It wasn't information that was readily available. At that time, we had these day passes you could get to other universities' libraries. I got a day pass to go down to Burlington, Vermont, and I, talked to the librarian, said, these are some items I'm looking for, some variables. I need the data to put into my study. Can you help me? And she's, thanking. She comes back to me about half an hour later, and she goes, the League of Women Voters. And I said, the what? And she said, the League of Women Voters. And she said, they collect all this data, and I have gathered these for you. And if you want to sit through these and sift through this, you could do it state by state. You can do it county by county. City by city, you can get all your data. Now, it's going to be a little cumbersome because it's not all collected in one spot, but they have it. So I spent the day and collected my data. I go back and I speak to my advisor and I said, look, this is the one variable that I'm a little weak on because it's something called the League of Women Voters. And I said, the librarian seemed to think that they were credible. And she said, the League of Women Voters, of course they're credible. Now, she also studied voting behavior around the world and she was very familiar with who they were. I went, okay, well, good. I have my data, I have my numbers, and away I went. So I didn't think much about the League of Women Voters after that, other than I was grateful for the fact they'd collected this data, and it was considered scholarly, or at least for an academic purpose. It was good. I liked that. I came to Charlottesville. I was volunteering at a, if I remember correctly, it was a county fair food booth, and there were a couple gentlemen who were there who were also volunteering, and one of them was Cy Becker, the other was Clarence McClymont, and they were asking about my history, and I, you know, where I was from, and what I was doing, and I was telling them, and they said, oh, well, you know, I said, you know, what organizations are you guys with, and they said, the League of Women Voters. I start to laugh, because here's a couple of fellas, right, going, the League of Women Voters, how'd they let you guys in, and found out, you know, it's not just for women. So that was kind of amusing. They said, and Clarence wouldn't let this go. He said, you have to come to one of our meetings. You have to come to a luncheon. And I said, I don't want to come to a luncheon. I got too much to do. I don't have time for that. Oh, yeah, you must come. I said, okay, sure. And, you know, don't think anything of it. Won't hear from Clarence again. But I do. They have this meeting coming up, and I forget what the topic was, but he has paid for my lunch. So I was going to the league meeting. I got there, and I was amazed at both. I mean, it was highly attended, but I was absolutely stunned by the questions that the audience were asking, who were the members of the League of Women Voters. And I was going, who are these high-minded women here? And there was also a few gentlemen as well. I mean, they were curious. They were, you know, to be a speaker at there was quite intimidating, I imagine, because they were like a dog with a bone. They had questions. They were, you know, they wanted answers. It was really quite interesting. So that's how I opened up, and that's how I joined the League of Women Voters. Now, being a Canadian, I wasn't allowed to register voters. I was allowed to join. I would take my dues, but there were rules. I wasn't allowed to, you know, register voters or participate in political forums, but I could write the newsletter. So for several years, I would write the newsletter. And again, this speaks to the membership of the League of Women Voters. One of the things at that time, the newsletter was paper, okay? So they mailed it out to people. So they had proofreaders, two women in the community who once a month I would have to take the newsletter, a hard copy, to one of the two women to read, to proofread it. Now, these women were extraordinarily entertaining and brilliant. One of them, who shall remain unnamed, I really enjoyed going to her house when she wanted me to deliver it in the afternoon. And when I delivered it in the afternoon, it meant that my Sunday afternoon before the newsletter was due, I had to go to her house around 2 o'clock and give her the newsletter. And she always had articles from newspapers, current events, magazines, The Economist, all these articles, The New Yorker. And she wanted to discuss at least one of them with me. And we always had a little drink of something. Now, I don't drink hard liquor, but so to this day, I don't know what that was, but I sure did it once a month on Sundays. Sunday afternoons, I had a wee nip with her, and we discussed what was relevant and going on in the world. And sometimes it was local, but quite often it was what was going on in the world. Now, the other proofreader, who I will name Leah Gropin, she had a different MO. If I was giving it to her to proofread, Leah's was, I had to come in the evening. It had to be at 7 o'clock on the Sunday before the newsletter was due. And she would have, we'd either have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. And she wanted me to understand the role of women in American society. And she was going to be my mentor. And she was. She started giving me books I had to read. I was my own little book club. She'd assigned these books. I still have many of the books she gave me. And then I would have to, if I saw her, I'd go, oh, no, she's doing the newsletter again next month. I got to get that book read. So sometimes I didn't have, like, 2 months in between. I would have a month in between and get her book read. And again, it was her, she wanted me to know and understand women in society, in politics, and there was all kinds of, the material that she gave me was multi-natured. Some of it very current, some of it not so current. Some of it really good, some of it not so good. But, it was her own little book club. So again, it was this idea, this influence that I needed to remain curious and be knowledgeable about what was going on in civic life and with women. So then what happens is I write the newsletter for 3 or 4 years, and then one of the members comes to the board, because when you write the newsletter, you're also a member of the board. And she comes to the board meeting and says, you have to get off the board. And I said, you know, I'm thinking, what did I do? Okay, so I can get myself in trouble now and then, but to get kicked off the board, you know? And she goes, no Canadians allowed on the board. You have to be Americans to be on the board. Now, I was going, well, okay, you know, you volunteer at things for so long, and sometimes your interest wanes. Maybe it was time to move on a little bit. These high-minded women were not letting me move on. It was, okay, you've been in the United States long enough. How can you live here and not vote? How can you stand that? Why are you not an American citizen? I kind of went, well, you know, I don't know. Do you ever plan on going back to Canada? Well, I like it here. I might raise my children here. You need to become an American citizen. I said, you're right. Now, at that moment, I agreed in principle. Yeah, you're right. But at that moment, I didn't immediately jump and do that. I didn't do that until they passed the Patriot Act. And then I went, oh, my goodness, one of us needs to be an American. Because the Patriot Act was kind of scary if you weren't an American at the time. So that's when I decided, well, and I was still, you know, active in the League of Women Voters. And I went, okay, I'm going to do this. So, you jump through some hoops, and it's actually quite an unpleasant experience, which is another topic happy to speak about sometime. But to become a citizen is quite an unpleasant experience with the relationships and the things that you have to go through to do it. One of the last steps is you go through all your hoops, and one of the last steps is you actually have to go show up at this point was the Office of the Homeland Security in D.C., and you have to answer these 10 questions, and you only have to answer 8 of them correctly. So if you get your first 8 right, you only have to answer 8 of them. And at that point, if you pass, they will give you put your name on a list to have an appointment to be sworn in. So I'm so excited I pass. I know the questions. The Leaguers have all been quizzing me. I mean, they had documents. I mean, I knew these questions hands down. Get my first 8 passed. And I think it's changed. Maybe it's 7 now, or maybe it was 7 then and it's 8 now, but I think the number has actually changed since that time. And I'm pretty excited, and the officer says, so where would you like to, or he said, okay, so you will be sworn in, and he gives the district court and the address and everything. I said, oh, no. I want to be sworn in at Monticello. And the officer says, what's Monticello? And I'm looking at him and I go, how'd you pass? Which probably wasn't that smart because he still controlled my life, but I couldn't resist. So I explained to him what it was. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, he said, look, I'll put that on the form. You may or may not get that, but you'll get a letter with your date and your appointment. So I'm all excited. I come back. I tell the League of Women Voters, I've done it. I'm doing this. I'm having a big party. And they're excited because I'm the first member they've ever had that's become an American citizen. And so I'm renting a big tent, and Mel's is coming to cater. I'm going to be sworn in on the 4th of July. And I've just told everybody and invited, half the world. I'm sorry if I missed you. And we're going to we're going to have this big party as I'm sworn in. My letter comes. I'm going to be sworn in June 20-something, and I'm going to be sworn in at this district court. I'm so upset. How can this be? I'm going to be sworn in at Monticello. So I phone. There's a number. I phone. You're supposed to phone to either accept or reject your appointment. And I phone. I go, you've got the wrong place. That's not where I want to be sworn in. I want to be sworn in at Monticello. Well, we have to get back to you. They get back to me. They say, well, it's full. You can't be sworn in there. So I go back to my friends at the League of Women Voters, and I go, you got to help me. What am I going to do? I can't be sworn in at Monticello. What about our party? I have to be up there. I have to be the first person you register that day. They go, you need to contact your senators. Tell them you're a member of the League of Women Voters. So I contact our senators, and at the time it's George Allen and John Warner. And I get a form letter back from John Allen saying that it's a process and, they have contacted and there's nothing that can be done. I get a letter back from John Warner's office who says, you need to contact Mrs. Crowder in our Roanoke office. Tell her that, explain to her your situation. So I call her up. Mrs. Crowder is absolutely delightful. And she's quite gruff. And she says, and I tell her the circumstances, and she says, well, let me see what I can do, and I'll get back to you. She calls about a week later, and she says, look, they're full. The only way you would get in there is if somebody isn't going to take their appointment. At this moment in time, everybody's taking their appointment. It's very close to the 4th. It's unlikely you're going to get in. You better go, you know, you better choose the district court. And I go, come on. You know, grant that. She says, no, they only take 75 people. I said, can it be 76? Come on. I went to Mr. Jefferson's University. I have a degree from there. You know, I studied him. And I'm thinking of all these things. 76, it's such a symbolic number. You gotta let me in. Go ask them. Ask them. She says, let me call you back. So I guess, you know, she calls Mac. I go to the League of Women Voters. I tell them, I'm really on the edge here. I don't think it's going to happen, you know, but, you know, I guess we'll have the party anyhow, but I'm really disappointed. In the meantime, at work, I have to travel, and I'm not in my office. And I get home, get back after a few days, and I get this, I listen to my voicemail, and there's this one from Mrs. Crowder. Please give me a call back. I listen to the next message. This is Mrs. Crowder. Would you please call me back? The third message is, I don't know where you are, but you need to call me right away. So I do. I don't even listen to the rest of my messages. I call her right away. And she says to me, you're in. Okay? I mean, you are the person they've allowed 76. You don't have to lose any weight, which apparently is the reason why they only have 75, is there's a weight limit on how many people can be on that, a weight limit on the stairs at Monticello. You know, because I had even bargained with her, I'll lose weight. I mean, tell me how much I have to weigh, right? So I'm in. And she said, now, will you please tell the League of Women Voters to stop writing, calling? Tell them you are in. So I tell you that story because I want you to know that the influence that this group has, you know, these are just anecdotal from academic credibility to this credibility and this influence with these legislators that they can just reach out to at any moment in time is really quite amazing to me. So, you know, I was sworn in. I'm an American citizen now, and I never miss a chance to vote. I love it. I love it. So you guys, you have fun. You go to your precincts. I go to the Miller School, or the Miller Center, and it's just on my way to work. And there's baking, and you know, it's a lot of fun. So I still don't understand why people don't vote, but that's what brought me to the League of Women Voters. And I will say that now, in the future, you know, the League of Women Voters needs to work on reaching women who are my age, who are starting to, there's a shift in the age that needs to happen, because Leaguers are, we have a senior age for the majority of our members, and we need to reach a younger audience. Now, women my age that are getting, you know, we're starting to get closer to retirement, thinking about it. Many of us have, you know, we are in organizations, but they're generally networking, right? It has something to do with our job or you know, an interest that we do, and we're networking with this association or that because it might help us get ahead in our careers or, you know, some influence that way. And what we don't understand, women my age and those of us that are quite familiar with the term of networking, is the influence and the force that the League of Women Voters has. And on the League of Women Voters side, what I would like to see happen is, okay, so let's go after that target group. Let's go after them. And I include men in this as well. With this, but let's target that group. But to do that, we need to be tweeting. We should be tweeting out here that we are, you know, speaking to the senior statesmen, quite an engaging audience too. You know, we should be on Pinterest. We should be on, you know, Google Plus. You should be getting our email just by the mere fact that you click on our Facebook. You know, there's all this technology and all this communication and networking that's going on socially that we haven't embraced necessarily. And I don't mean this as chastising to us, because we don't embrace it because a lot of us don't understand it. And who has the time? It's a volunteer organization. Who has the time for this? So I'm quite hopeful that, well, who has the time for this? If we had a paid employee, we could employ somebody who could do this correctly. So Those are the kind of things that I wanted to leave you with just anecdotally about my experiences with the League of Women Voters, and I think that it has a strong future. I think that, you know, part of it is getting their narrative out, getting their story out, and that this is why I thank you so much to the senior statesmen for actually inviting us to come here to speak, because you've made us had to think about that. We've made a first step. We actually have a slideshow now with a little bit of a history of the League of Women Voters. I would like to get, you know, you have to reach in locally. I was at, I don't know if any of you knew Sally Mead or Boots Mead, you know, at a party at Boots's one time, I saw this great picture on the mantle in their dining room of these women in Richmond sitting around, you know, that centerpiece in downtown Richmond, and they are clearly from the 1900s. They have their long skirts on, their hats, their boots, and my understanding, I think, was that this was Sally Jackson's mother, Sally Mead's mother, and there was about five or six of them, and they're leaning against this cart, and they have this white sign that says League of Women Voters on it. And so there's an actual photograph of that sitting on Boots's sideboard there in his dining room. So it really is, there's a good narrative, it's a good organization, and thank you to the statesmen for having us and getting our narrative out there. And
thank you very much, folks. I want to... are there any questions at this point you have for the league?
Have you figured out why we have such a low voter turnout? Is it because easy come, easy go?
Yeah, that is kind of an interesting question, because I would like to say empirically I could show, yes, this made a difference. But then things came along like motor voter law, and you know, being able to registration became simpler. And quantitatively, it was not, you know, I could neither prove or disprove that that was a major factor. So sadly, I came to change my mind a little bit on that, though, thinking it might not be the structures and that it might be more related to people who feel like they have something to lose. And the reason I say that is because I happened at the time I was in Montreal. I don't know if you know anything about Canadian politics, but it was run by the separatist government who wanted to secede from Canada, the Bloc Québécois, and our taxes used to be paid along Catholic and Protestants. We actually, you know, our education was either Catholic or Protestant. It goes back to the French and English. And Quebec, most of the Catholic schools were French, and the Protestant schools in Quebec were the English, Irish, you know. And when they changed that that law to make it either French and English in Quebec, they then would automatically sign all taxpayers' money to go to the Catholic or to the French schools. School board, and the English payers' taxes, unless you opted out, would also go to the French school board as a way to eliminate English school board. So they held a referendum, an election. People protested. So they had a little referendum election to it. This is about school boards. They had a 97% turnout amongst English voters, and they had, like, I think it was like 17% out of French or non-English voters, non-Anglophones, they called them. That experience alone made me rethink my cumbersome registration process, saying, no, the Anglophones turned out because they felt like they had something to lose. And why didn't the Francophones turn out? Well, you didn't really have anything to lose. So if I were to look at it again, to spend time studying that, I think that that's what the school of thought I may favor. All debatable, of course.
And I think this is something that the League really recognizes. Our work doesn't stop. We have to engage the young people and tell them they have something to lose if they do not step up.
What would you tell them?
The control of their life. when you're 17, you're not going to listen to that, I know. So it's an ongoing process. And some people will listen in different ways. It didn't take much for me to learn that I should be active as a citizen. My parents voted, didn't talk about politics, but I know they went to vote. And just that little bit, I learned it's something I should do. And, you know, democracy wasn't going to work if I didn't step up. And so this is what I think is so important for the League to do, and we try. And I don't think it's a continual ball game. It's not going to end.
Are there a couple of issues, 2, 3, 1, that you're currently studying, or if you don't have those, are there issues that one or two that you would like to be studying going forward? What are the hot issues either for Charlottesville or Virginia?
One we just voted on.
Yeah, we just had a state convention in Charlottesville. And one of the things we voted on that the League in Charlottesville had suggested, we study fracking and pipeline in Virginia. And so we held a caucus. I led it because I had led our program that selected this. But anyway, it was people came. There were quite a number that came to our little caucus at 8 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. And so it voted by a large margin. And I'm very happy. And our current president of the league is here, Ann Sterling. Ann, you remember that. And this is Ann Sterling, everybody. Glad to have you.
I have to say I'm just so delighted to come and hear our Charlottesville. We need a mic.
They're very good at podcasting, Ann. You're behind it.
No, we are very proud of our Charlottesville League. The league exists across Virginia. And we have a state board to which Pat Hurst has just been elected. The new state board will take over on July 1st, and all the weight will slip off of my shoulders onto the new board. But we're very proud of our Charlottesville Area League because they are one of our leading leagues around Virginia, and they have shown leadership in a number of places, and so we're very grateful to them, and we're so delighted at the interest that they continually seem to elicit around the Charlottesville area. You all are a very good example, so very happy to be here with you.
Thank you. Let me mention a couple of other things in addition to fracking. We've been very interested in redistricting in Virginia, and we've been supportive of that and worked with other groups. We also are very concerned about visibility in the legislative process. And Ann has been very connected with other groups that are working that at the state level. So those are three examples.
And if I can just add, sort of combine both those questions, I would say, if somebody said to me, you know, how do you persuade somebody that they should be active or care what goes on? I would simply say, what's important to you? And then I would say to them, do you know that you could join the League of Women Voters? You could gather a group of high-minded people and persuade them. Again, to me, it's an organization of persuasion. That if this is good governance, if this is it makes society and life better, and you are able to get your positions adopted, get enough people to agree with you, you have some influence in the process besides your vote.
The League of Women Voters, is there another question?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for coming. This is kind of an historical question. Jeanette Rankin joined the House of Representatives in 1917. Although she didn't have the right to vote until 1920. Her votes in in the House during that period of 3 years, if was she ever on the majority side of a vote that a major decision was made, and would her vote have counted, and would that be actionable in law? You understand where I'm going with this?
Because I'm following you.
Because that's interesting. I mean, rights as far as her votes did the guys allow her? She was obviously a citizen, but even though she was not a voting citizen, was there any discussion of that at the time and since by scholars?
That's a very interesting question. And I would imagine that since the Congress has its own requirements for seating a representative, and if she met those requirements, then she's entitled to vote, if that was the nature of your question.
The influence.
So it would not be dependent upon voting outside of that for our elective officials, but once you're there, you can vote.
I don't know the answer to that question either, but it's interesting and curious, and I think you should study this for us.
Sounds like a PhD.
Yeah. But I would think that it was probably, you know, just a hunch you'd be marginalized. But I would look at it this way, you know, so she made it. She was there. You're kind of like a polka dot on a long piece of fabric of polka dotted fabric. Nobody notices necessarily, thinks you can make a difference because you're just a polka dot on this big piece of fabric. But you look at that fabric and there's one dot that's missing, there's something wrong. Something's not right. Something's not going to work 100%. And I think that, you know, maybe she was that polka dot. Maybe she didn't influence necessarily change minds, but she was there, she opened doors. And somebody has to always do that. But I would say she was the polka dot. Oh, good.
I think also that it is one thing to get elected. It's another thing to actually be able to influence legislation as a member of the legislature. And we in the League are very aware of the plight of women elected to the General Assembly of Virginia in the early years, which really lasted into well into the last century. 35 years ago, in the early 80s, there was a group of women legislators who at the General Assembly, both senators and delegates, just a few women, who got tired of having their bills taken as jokes and just automatically tossed aside, not passed in committee. They determined to go directly to the public, to appeal to the public, to put pressure on legislators to take their bills seriously. And they founded something called the Women's Roundtable. And they discussed their bills and invited the public who were at the General Assembly to come and listen to what they were trying to accomplish. Therein was born the Women's Legislative Roundtable. After a few years, the women legislators realized they were getting more traction. But they thought they had started something pretty good, and so they turned it over to the League of Women Voters of Virginia to run. And ever since then, the League has run a weekly roundtable during the session where any legislator can come and discuss his bills and appeal to those in the audience. And so I know that all three of our panelists have been to the legislative roundtable. Traditionally, the president of the League of Women Voters of Virginia presides each week, and it is a wonderful institution. And so we are carrying that on to this day. And I will just end by saying today, women legislators are taken pretty seriously. They don't have nearly the same trouble getting their bills passed and having major influence.
Thank you. We have time for one more last question.
If there are no more questions, I'll take the time to tell you that I hope you will consider all of you joining the League of Women Voters. You can spend 5 minutes or your lifetime within the League. And one of the best things the League does at the state level is at the round table and the person on the state board, because during the time of the General Assembly, around 11 o'clock or midnight, I, as who happens to be president, gets an email saying, "Bill such and such is on the table, or it's in committee, it's 7 in the morning, we need you to contact your legislators immediately and see, you know, and put forth the League position." This is just wonderful. It works. And there you are in your PJs at 1 in the morning or at 7 in the morning when you get up. You have the information and you can immediately contact your legislator. This is a wonderful service that the State League has provided. Join the League. We do a lot of things locally. We'll keep you advised of that through any means we can, one of them being Charlottesville Tomorrow, who has come and listened to us today. So thank you very much.
So now you have two organizations to join. Karen, Pat, and Jerry. I'm sorry. Thank you very much for coming today. We've all learned a lot. I do want to remind you that there will be no Senior Statesmen of Virginia meeting next month in July. We'll be back in full form in August. Thank you for being here today. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.